Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. Okay, here goes. SeaMonkey, that's the first one. SeaMonkey Internet Application Suite. This contains a web browser, an email client, a newsgroup client, an RSS feed reader, IRC chat, HTML editor, web development environment. Why haven't you heard of this before? Well, you may have heard of it before. It does ship with Slackware. You do have it on your computer. In other words, it's a client that lets you browse the web from lots of different sort of angles, many points of access, HTTP, UUNP? I'm thinking of UUCP, aren't I? Anyway, lots of different aspects of the web you can browse. Plus, you can build a website for yourself, and you can maintain communication with whatever community you're a part of through IRC chat or RSS or, you know, however you kind of want to connect with people. Email, obviously. SeaMonkey was developed originally around the time when Netscape forked its web browser Netscape Navigator, over to Mozilla Foundation, which I talked about, four episodes ago, when I was talking about Mozilla Firefox and Thunderbird, or one episode ago, I don't know, whenever that was. And it uses much of the same source code from Mozilla Firefox source code that specifically powers Thunderbird. So I don't know, I can't trace that lineage myself. I can't visualize it without sort of going back to their repository maybe and sort of looking at a long, long history. Not worth it. Point is, you're kind of familiar with this if you've been a Firefox user for any amount of time or a Thunderbird user. If you try to use SeaMonkey today as your daily browser, I think you'll discover pretty early on that you're probably going to have to adjust some of your muscle memory, some of your habits. The UI is going to be familiar to anyone who's familiar with Firefox, but interestingly, the back end feels a lot more like Thunderbird, which I don't know if I can explain that. I mean, it's probably something you have to think about and experience, and maybe you wouldn't even agree. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe what I'm picking up on is that Thunderbird was always a little bit behind Firefox, you know? So it's kind of like maybe this just feels like Firefox 3 or something like that, which seems crazy because what are we on? Firefox 128 now or something. The version number got a sudden bump at one point and just kind of kept going up from there. But yeah, I don't know. It feels familiar yet different is what I'm trying to express. And one way to kind of to really get a feel for that is to go to the add-ons manager. Like Firefox, it has the ability, well, and Thunderbird, has the ability to get add-ons. So you go to the tools menu, click on add-ons manager, and then you can install add-ons and themes, but not the way that you think you can, because, and it'll lie to you. SeaMonkey lies to you. So if you click on themes, like the theme category in this add-on manager, you'll see that it's got two built-in themes, one active, the other disabled. And then there's a message along the top of the window that says that you need to, or that if you want to, you can choose from thousands of themes, which itself is a link that takes you to Thunderbird's theming website. Now, that's not the right website. Because if you click on a download now button on any theme that you see there, then you end up with an XPI file, which you might recognize as the file type for Mozilla extensions, or at least it used to be. I haven't seen one lately in a long time because it just all happens in the background. So you end up with this XPI file on your PC in your downloads folder. And then you can go back to the themes panel in SeaMonkey, click the little cogwheel icon in the top right corner, and select install add-on from file. This is the old Thunderbird method of doing this. You choose the XPI file that you just downloaded, and then you get a message telling you that the file you're trying to install was downloaded from an unknown source and is corrupt, or appears to be corrupt, or something like that. And that happens with every theme XPI file that I tried. So it wasn't just like one bad one. I tried several. It happened reliably. So here's how to get it to work the way that it works. Although, like I say, like it it's lying to you. It tries to trick you and make you do what I just did and not work. But what you can do instead is click on the Get Add-ons category on the left of the Add-ons Manager panel. And you have to do this every time you want to install something. That's where you go. The other categories are just for enabling and disabling and removing add-ons, but never to install. So just get that out of your head, even though the SeaMonkey browser itself tries to convince you otherwise. On the right side of the Get Add-ons panel, the one that I'm telling you you can use to install stuff through, there are two links. One goes to all add-ons and the other goes to themes. Now, for whatever reason, when you click on those, they take you to a SeaMonkey, not Thunderbird, add-ons page, and the buttons next to each like add-on or theme that you might want to install reads, instead of download now, it says add to SeaMonkey. And you can click that button. It'll pop up a little warning sign that you're about to install a theme or an add-on. You click OK and it works like a charm. Everything gets installed. You can go enable it and activate it in the other categories. And it's fine. It works. Well, mostly it works. I did download a theme called, I think it was Gnome Runner, that broke all the icons in the SeaMonkey UI, so there were no icons anywhere anymore. I don't know why. I don't know what happened there. I guess maybe I needed, I don't know. It should have told me that I needed a certain icon set, I guess, would be my preference. It didn't. It just broke it. So most of the ones I tried, though, did work as expected, at least the ones that were still supported by SeaMonkey. A lot of them were too old to be supported by my, I guess, modern version of SeaMonkey. And all around, I would say that, you know, this is a modern version of SeaMonkey. It's like 2021 is the build. Although, I mean, a new one was just released like in September, I think, of 2024. So like it is still in development, but there are little touches, at least in this 2021 version. I didn't try 2024's version. I considered it, but it requires a lot of build things that I just didn't want to have to go through. I could have tried to build it with Pat's build script. I mean, that's what I would do, but it just, I don't know. There were a lot of things like a Google API that you need to enable Google Safe Browsing or something. I don't even know what that is. But anyway, there are little touches here and there that you'd expect, I think, in SeaMonkey, I mean, based on your experience with modern Firefox, that are just missing. Like, for instance, there's not a button on each tab to close that tab. There's a button to close the current tab, but it's way over on the right. So realistically, you're not going to move your mouse all the way over to the right to close your current tab. You're probably going to just right click on your current tab itself and close it that way, or just use a keyboard shortcut. It's not something I would have said that I would miss if you took away. And yet seeing a browser without that minor convenience function makes me realize how often I actually use it, closing tabs all the time with a little X on the tab. I think there's a good argument that it doesn't need that button. Like I say, there are other ways to do it, and maybe when moving tabs around, you might accidentally click that close button. So there's an argument there. I'm just saying, based on my experience, I expected it to be there. It wasn't. I didn't see a way to make it be there, so it just felt like there was something missing. My must-have add-ons don't seem to be available in SeaMonkey at all. And weirdly, there's a print this page button in the top right of the browser, like by default. Like, who prints pages off of the internet anymore? It just seems like a really archaic kind of option to have, taking up space in the UI by default. But in terms of doing what it says it can do, SeaMonkey works. It's a web browser. It's got a Usenet browser and an email client. Now, whether or not you want a chat and email client in the same suite as your browser is a matter of preference. I don't think it's my preference, to be honest. But then again, maybe I only say that because I use separate clients now. Although I have said before on this show that I do tend to prefer the separate clients. But I mean, there's always an exception, you know, like LMMS is great. And its main appeal is that it takes a bunch of disparate synth modules and sticks them into one application, into one little workspace. So there are definitely exceptions to sort of, oh, everything must be modular. I do think it's healthy for the internet. to have tools available for building websites. And that's something that SeaMonkey has, and I think it's always had, and I think it's really important for that to exist, and I wish it existed in modern web browsers. Building a site these days is admittedly a lot more complex than it used to be. You used to just code stuff in basic HTML. That's all you had to account for. Maybe you didn't even need to know CSS, but people expect a lot out of web pages now, for better or for worse. And besides that, there's the question of finding a web host and figuring out how to get your files from your build tool to the server and how to connect your domain to the host and all these other things. It's really complex. But despite all of those sort of roadblocks, and frankly, I don't think a roadblock like that is an excuse for saying, well, we just can't do this then. Because, I mean, identifying a roadblock means that's an opportunity to fix a roadblock. So I think having an easy and casual way to throw a web page together is an important feature for a web browser to have, because that demonstrates to people that the web isn't meant to be a consumer experience. You can help build the web. You can contribute content. This is meant to be a collaborative experience built by people, not corporations, a way to share ideas and knowledge. So SeaMonkey, to me, is a very interesting project because it does try to deliver a complete web experience to an audience that has arguably decided that the internet is pretty much a place for virtual storefronts and data brokers. It's exciting and encouraging that it is an active project, that people still put time and effort towards this little project. It's good to have. So hypocritically, I'm still not going to use it as my main browser. But I do like that it's there. And I guess to be fair, I don't think I would use it even if I wouldn't use it because I'm humbly beyond the need for like little GUI driven HTML web builders. But certainly I already have an email client. You know, I have all the components that are here. I like that it has all those components though. And I think on some level I identify strongly with what it represents. Does that mean anything? I mean, I'm not going to use it. I'm not going to recommend it to people. So does it? I don't know. I don't know what I want to happen. I guess what I want to happen is to rewind the whole internet about 20 years and kind of course correct and really avoid the corporate dystopia that the WWW has become. Okay, so next up is Seon, or Seon, S-E-Y-O-N. It's a complete full-featured telecommunication package for the X window system. I have no idea what this means. Turns out, after a little struggle of research, it's an application for interacting basically with like BBS systems and probably like Telnet and other really basic forms of network communication. It seems to rely on a literal modem, like not a colloquial modem, like a real modem that's going to dial, you know, on a phone line or something. And I think it would presumably require a remote destination to be of any use. I could not figure out a way to actually experience this application myself. It seems probably like some retro computer fan out there would really love this application, but I wouldn't even begin to know where to start with it. Unlike SSR, which is the next package in this list, thus SSR is the simple screen recorder. It's a screen capture application. I use it frequently for gaming videos that I do, actually. You launch it. It steps you through some options for what you want to record. Like you can record just one screen if you have a multiple screen setup, or multiple screens. You can record audio or no audio. You can do just a portion of the screen and so on. And then it encodes as it records. So you save your output to basically any video format supported by FFmpeg, libav codec, whatever we want to call it. And then you end up with a little movie of everything you've done. And you can import that into like Kden Live or something and edit it down if you need to. I've been using this for years now, and I had no idea it actually even came pre-installed with Slackware. I had kind of assumed I'd found it and installed it myself, but there it is in the package list. Who knew? It's a great application. I love it. It's exactly what you want in a screen recorder. Sometimes something like OBS, like Open Broadcast Studio, is, I mean, it's a great application, but sometimes that's just overkill. You don't need all that. You just want to record what you're seeing on your screen. You don't need overlays or picture in picture, or you don't need to switch from inputs and outputs. Simple screen recorder is just that. It is simple, effective, a real pleasure to use. Highly recommend it if you need to record your screen. Next package in the list is Vim-GVim. This is a graphical client for Vim. I don't use Vim. I'm not very aware of trends among Vim users, but I do have a feeling that, like, most, with quotes around most, because I have no actual data and I'm just making stuff up here, most Vim users probably don't use a graphical client, because it just seems to me like one of the appeals of Vim is that it is mostly built for the terminal. And I do think that's how most users interact with it. I could be wrong. As an Emacs user, I will say that I do use the graphical UI for Emacs quite often. And in fact, I'll be perfectly honest, it was the GUI of Emacs that got me to finally sort of understand Emacs. I don't remember why, but having that GUI there just really kind of helped me visualize some of the concepts of Emacs. So I'm a really, really big fan of the graphical UI for Emacs, and I do use it quite often. Although now that I've gotten like good enough with Emacs, I use the -NW option to just run it in a terminal probably just as often as, maybe not just as often as I use the graphical, but very frequently. I'm very frequently just running it in a terminal. And like thinking of other text editors that I use, like the Nano text editor, I if it had a client, I probably wouldn't use it. But I do like that there are graphical clients available. They feel like a nice thing to have. I don't know why. Maybe there's just that, you know, that mythical user out there who for some reason wants to use Vim but doesn't want to use a terminal. I don't know. It feels like it's a problem that doesn't need to be solved. But here it is. Here's the solution. If you are looking for a graphical client for Vim, you've got one with GVim. Okay, the next package is Window Maker, which is an entire desktop environment. So let's go get a cup of coffee before we tackle that. Good luck. We're back with coffee. I get this really, because I live in a very small town now with lots of farmers around, and so I get this milk from the store that I guess it's like full cream milk or something. And so the first dollop of milk that you get out of this bottle is a very creamy dollop. Like it's basically full cream. So I got lucky today and happened to be the person to open the new bottle of milk, and just, this is the creamiest coffee. And when I say creamiest, I mean like cream. Like in the US we would have called it heavy cream, which turns out is fake. There's no such, it's just cream, but I didn't know that. The US calls cream lots of different things for no good reason, apparently. But yeah, this is just really, this is the closest thing to half and half you get, really, you know, because I mean, it's cream and milk. It's not really half and half, but it is close to it, which is a flavor profile that I sometimes miss, because I frequently ended up having coffee with half and half back in the States a decade ago, and I'm still missing it. It's really weird. Let's talk about Window Maker. So Window Maker is essentially the GNU version of the Next Step desktop, which was designed for a company called Next, which was a Unix operating system back in the 90s-ish. And in fact, it was the earliest form of Mac OS. I mean, Mac OS existed before Next, but it was called like System 7 and System 8 and System 9. I don't know. I don't remember why they called it like System something, but that's what they called it, I think. That's my memory of it. And when Mac OS 10 came out, that was the line in the sand, partly because of its bold new look, but actually because it was Next. It was Next ported to a Mac, or you know, like it was Next with an Apple logo on it and much prettier graphics, as it turns out. Many of the modern Mac interface conventions, like a dock that holds your open but minimized applications and frequently launched applications, some of the ways the control panels looked, that's not so much true anymore, actually. That was early OS X had control panels a lot like Next Step. The reality that the desktop is another is just another application, that's a big one. That was blowing people's minds when Mac OS X was first coming out. I saw several demos at computer stores where the guy would, he'd just force quit the desktop. And to most people, once again, at least in the Mac world, most people, like, the desktop was the computer. Like, there's no separation between sort of what you see and what's really happening. Like, it's just, here's the Finder. That's what we called the desktop back in the Mac world. This is the Finder. So if that goes away, my whole computer goes away. Like, you can't have one without the other. And so I saw demos where the main selling point sort of to try to convince people that Mac OS X was honestly better than System 9 was that a guy would launch one application and then force quit the desktop, and that other application continued to run. It blew people's minds. So anyway, these conventions, these concepts started at Next Step, and they continued at some point. Like, Next was going out of business or something, and I think, bizarrely, I think Sun Microsystems was involved somehow, and they open sourced the Next Step. I don't know. Was it just the desktop code or something, or was it? I'm not really sure, but it must have maybe it was everything. I don't know. I don't remember. But they open sourced a big chunk of code, and GNU Step sort of got started, and it was this initiative to re-implement Next Step as an open source entity. And it made real progress, I guess. But I mean, the main thing that it produced in the end, certainly the thing that we really, really have still today, is Window Maker. And I don't know, I've always been a little bit confused about, is it GNU Step or is it Window Maker? So I don't know. I kind of use the two terms interchangeably, but I have a feeling probably GNU Step is the bigger project, and Window Maker happens to be the desktop sort of built within that. To further confuse things, if you want, there is another project. I don't know if it's even a project anymore, but there was a project at one point about 8 years ago called Etoile, Etoile, OS.com, Etoile. And they intended to iterate upon GNU Step and Window Maker and kind of make that into a modern reality, really. As I recall, their goal was to get sort of GNU Step up and running with, like, free and open source Objective-C libraries and Cocoa toolkit stuff running on Linux, kind of like Wine HQ has produced so many libraries to run Windows applications natively, literally natively on Linux. That was kind of part of the goal of Etoile, if I'm recalling correctly. That might have been kind of pie in the sky even at the time, but that was kind of the direction everyone hoped they were going in. I think it's something that they talked about, unless I'm misremembering. It was an attractive thing. I mean, it very much felt like, yeah, Window Maker could really use this, but in the back of your head, or at least in the back of my head, I also kind of felt like, couldn't you just do a cool theme for Window Maker and just leave it at that? So anyway, aside from this rich history, Window Maker looks and feels a lot like any other box window manager, like Fluxbox, Blackbox, OpenBox, and so on. Or rather, I should say, the box window managers feel a lot like Window Maker, because I'm pretty sure Window Maker, or at least Next Step, were before they existed. And you can obviously try it out. It's installed on Slackware. So you use xwmconfig and select wmaker as your default xinit rc entry, and then just do a start x. Okay, so you get a desktop. And as with those box type window managers. You right click in, you know, any empty space on the desktop and you get an application menu. If you don't launch an application, strangely, you have to right click somewhere else to make that application window go away. So I know modern sensibilities would be like, oh, I didn't do anything, so I'll do a left click somewhere to sort of clear everything. But no, it's got to be another right click. It's really weird. I don't know how to modify what apps are listed in the application window like I could on Fluxbox. I've just never looked into it. But I mean, it's Linux. It's possible. I just don't know how to tell you to do that. There's also a configuration application that is specific to GNU Step or Window Maker, whatever. I hate it. It's got bad layout. The tooltips aren't on by default. There's a selection down at the bottom that says like help balloons or something like that, and you can turn those on, but there are no labels, so you're supposed to divine what each category is just from the icon, and they're not beautiful icons. I don't like the side scrolling thing. It's a bad idea. I don't know why anyone would have ever implemented this. But it does help you to adjust settings for your little window maker UI. So it is important. It's good to know about. It's the configure window maker option there in the main application menu. So let's assume that you launch an application and you see, when it gets launched, it spawns not only the window that you would expect from an application, but it also spawns this little docklet icon on your desktop. And so, like on macOS 10, if you've seen it, I haven't seen it recently, but I'm pretty sure that it still has like a dock at the bottom, a shelf at the bottom. And that's where applications pop up when you launch them. A little representation of that application pops up. So this is like that, except there's no visible dock. It's just this little docklet icon down at the bottom left of your screen. When you click the minimize button on the title bar of the application you have launched, and the minimize button is the far left button, the app gets reduced down to, strangely, a second icon, also in the left corner. It's a little clunky to have two icons representing functionally the same thing, but you can think of it as kind of like the first icon is the application, and the second one represents a specific instance, a distinct window of that application. I admit, a little clunky. There's a lot here that just doesn't quite feel refined or streamlined. It feels a little quaint, you know, kind of old and like, oh, they hadn't thought of that yet, huh? So anyway, in the top left of the screen, there's a paperclip. This is not a clipboard. You're going to try to make it be a clipboard. Every time I see it, I think, there's my clipboard. No, it's not a clipboard. It's actually a task manager or a task bar manager and a workspace manager. So you can right click on the clip and select attract icons to pull all your application icons into the upper left corner. And then from there, that's just a convenience function. Like pulling, attracting icons to major UI elements is something that you can do, which is interesting. So when you right click on an application icon, you can select keep icon to sort of pin that icon as a launcher to your desktop. So that sounds familiar, right? You can do that in KDE. You can do that in KDE. You don't have to pin them to the top left. That was just an example. You can pin them anywhere. You can right click an application and say keep. No, I think actually the keep icon, I don't know. It seems to vary when you see the keep icon option. And there is another way to do this as well, which I'll go over in a minute. But the clip also is a manager for a virtual desktop, or your virtual desktops rather. So you can middle click on the clip and then use the menu that appears to create or destroy a new desktop. And then you can click one of the arrows and now you're on the new desktop. The GNU Step icon in the top right corner, I think that's a GNU Step one, is where you adjust your dock settings more or less. It's all very malleable and I struggle to try to kind of define the different elements here. But the GNU Step icon is kind of the hub for dockable icons. You can create a drawer from the GNU Step icon and then move icons in next to the drawer, and that puts it into the drawer. You still have to click on the drawer to collapse the drawer and hide those icons, which again, a little clunky, but then you can move the GNU Step icon around and anything attached to it moves along with it. So you're functionally moving basically your dock. Although it's important to note that's not the dock, it's just a dock. Like, everything is kind of, like, dockable, meaning they're icons that kind of snap to the edges of your screens, of your screen when you want them to. And that's kind of what Window Maker is. I don't know why they call it Window Maker. They should call it Icon Maker, Dock Maker. I don't know. There's a lot of minute ways to affect how icons are placed and handled on the desktop, to the extent that I feel that the desktop itself is mostly an elaborate, customizable application menu. Or application screen. You're building the way you want to interact with the state of an app, which apps you want to have quick access to, how you want to categorize those apps, and so on. It is so meticulous and precise that it's just really one step, or GNU step, away from an interface designer, and I really like this concept. I would not mind seeing this iterated upon, frankly. I mean, I think it does betray many of the concepts of what a desktop is meant to do, which I know some people to this day struggle with. For a lot of people, the desktop is still just the bucket into which you put literally all of your files, which is horrible. But I think it's arguable that this system that Window Maker is using uses the desktop real estate a lot better than any other desktop does, to be honest. Because, I mean, when I click the super button, the little Windows button, whatever, a Cooler Master button, whatever it's got, whatever icon it's got on your keyboard, on like GNOME, it brings up an entire screen that has a bunch of different categories for applications, or I can just start typing the name of an application to launch it. And that's great, but it's not a very configurable screen. So just imagine instead if you pressed super, I don't know, and made all of the windows on your desktop sort of disappear for a minute, and then you just had access to your desktop. Doesn't that just kind of make sense? And that gives you a lot of flexibility too when you've got like this kind of robust interactions possible. Like you can make docs and you can put them in drawers and you can put them in corners and you can move them around and you can keep them or you can pin them or you can make them span all of your desktop. You know, it's just, I don't know. It's kind of fascinating to me. And I would be curious to see someone kind of taking this idea and running with it. And frankly, I think that in Linux, we are very progressive in the sense, if nothing else, in the sense, I mean, I think we're very progressive. That's a full sentence. But I also think that one of the ways that we are very progressive is that we do kind of, we're doing weird things with the desktop. Like I don't even know how to put icons on my desktop in KDE. Is it a can I do that? I don't even know. I don't want to try. I'm afraid to try. But, you know, like, it's just not something that I think about. Whereas back in the old days, that was just where you put all of the applications that you wanted to launch and most of your files, until every 4 or 6 or 9 months you took all those files, made a new folder called Organize Me, and put all those files into the folder called Organize Me, and then started the whole cycle over again. All right. Anyway, that's Window Maker. It's, you know, there's, I mean, outside of the desktop itself, it's basically just a window manager, really. I mean, you launch applications, you interact with applications. That's what you do. Like, it's, you know, the desktop part is just the desktop. You might notice, might not. I didn't mention a network manager. I didn't mention a system tray of any kind. Those don't exist. That's not a thing. You have to build this up in the same way that you'd have to build Fluxbox or Blackbox or whatever, TWM, VWM. You have to add those applets yourself, or technically docklets. I've talked about docklets a little bit back in Fluxbox. They're tiny little applications, frequently starting with WM, interestingly, Window Maker. And they launch as little docklets, but they're fully functional as a docklet. In other words, it's a docklet with no larger window behind it or inside of it. You could click it all day and nothing's going to happen. Well, something might happen, but it's not, you know, it's not a window that you've minimized. It is just a fully functional applet that sits in your dock. So those are really useful. I used to use, well, I have a whole list of the ones that I was using on Fluxbox. They add a lot to a window manager for functionality, but there are also other ways you could do things. You could launch an XFCE panel or another panel of your choice and create a little system tray for yourself. You know, lots of different options. It's very modular. Window Maker allows for that as well. Next up, X11-SSH-AskPass. This is a graphical dialog box. so that you can enter your SSH key password when you use the SSH add command. The SSH-add command adds a private key to your OpenSSH authentication agent. I have never had to use it, and when I did try it for this episode, I couldn't get the X11-SSH-ask pass dialog box to show up. Now, I witnessed it by going to /usr/libexec/x11-ssh-ask pass. That launches it, so you can see it for yourself. You can type a word into it. Nothing happens to it, to the word, but you can do it. So if you really, really want to see it, you can. But in theory, you're supposed to be able to do this with SSH-add. That's supposed to be the default. What I tried was SSH-keygen, and I made a new key and just saved it to my RAM disk. And then I did SSH-add RAM disk sample key, and then it prompted me for a password right there in the terminal as usual. So, and you do need to assign a password to the key in order to be prompted for it. So if you do try this, ensure that you do actually create a password for the key. It'll let you create a key without a password, but if you do that, then you'll definitely never see X11-SSH-ask pass. The dialog box itself, I have to warn you, if you're going to go try this, it's really basic. And frankly, I have no idea why you would want to use it rather than just typing your password into a terminal where you're typing your SSH stuff anyway. Like, that's your SSH. That's where you're launching stuff. I don't know why you would want to launch a dialog box just to do that. I don't understand that. Although that said, I think GNOME has lately done some similar things, or maybe even KDE, the Plasma Desktop, possibly. It is a little jarring, but for some reason it doesn't bother me. So the concept, I guess, isn't atrocious. It's just a little puzzling, maybe, like, why this exists still. Like, it's such a basic window. And I cannot imagine this being a welcome addition to my session personally. So I don't know. It exists. It's there. You can try it. Next up is X3270, which is something you probably can't try, but that does exist. It's an emulator for the IBM 3270 terminal. I don't know what an IBM 3270 is. Here's a intro paragraph or two from the Wikipedia page, because it is vaguely interesting. The IBM 3270 is a family of block-oriented display and printer computer terminals introduced by IBM in 1971. It's normally used to communicate with IBM mainframes. The 3270 was the successor to the 2260, and unlike a character-oriented terminal, the 3270 minimizes the number of I/O interrupts required by transferring large blocks of data known as data streams, and uses a high-speed proprietary communications interface using a coaxial cable. IBM doesn't manufacture a 3270 terminal anymore, but the protocol is still common with the TN3270 clients, 3270 terminal emulation, or even web interfaces to access mainframe-based applications, sometimes referred to, apparently, as green screen applications. So I don't have a mainframe on hand, so I can't test this application beyond launching it. If you happen to have a mainframe in your closet, first of all, make sure that you're air conditioning it very well. I've heard they get hot. And then go to the Connect menu at the top and give it a go. Good luck. Let me know how it goes. Next up is, I guess it would be pronounced Xaos, X-A-O-S. I don't know if you've ever tried to explain to someone what a fractal is. It is quite difficult to describe, rough sketches on napkins rarely capture the awe and wonder of, say, a good Julia set. But with Xaos, you don't have to. You can just show them a fractal. That's what Xaos is. Xaos is one of those curious applications that kind of looks simple at first, and then it surprises you with, like, this secret world of options, kind of like a fractal, I guess. For instance, when you launch Xaos, the first thing you see is a fairly run-of-the-mill Mandelbrot set. When I first discovered Xaos, frankly, that was good enough for me. I'd been searching for a fractal generator for literal years. So finding an application that actually rendered a fractal for me, I mean, that was worth the price of admission. Like, that was my migration to Linux had been justified at that point. But you can poke around a little bit into Xaos's GUI client, and you'll discover that clicking and dragging on the fractal moves you closer to it, dynamically rendering all those little intricate details of that fractal as you get closer. So yeah, this is an interactive window. Okay, so if that's not enough, there are yet more options bound to both the on-screen menu, which you can get to when the mouse cursor is hovering kind of near the top of the Zeos window, and a couple of different hotkeys. So for instance, you can create your own Julia set dynamically by pressing J, appropriately enough, or change the type of the set to render from the fractal to formula menu. But that's just the technical options. Like, Zeos is all about rendering fractions, so there are plenty of options to change how the fractals are presented. You can change from 2D to pseudo 3D, which is amazing. Like, if you thought fractals in 2D were cool, try seeing the pseudo 3D representation. You can alter the colors, you can force constant rotation, so you don't even have to interact with it. You can just sit and watch it rotate. Enable autopilot so you can fly along the fractal's paths. You can add a motion blur. You can use it as sort of a VJ mode, so you can manipulate and control Zeos without the text rendering, so you can just use it as like a background at a music show or something like that. It's an amazing application. I love it. It's just one of those that'll never get old. Definitely check it out if you're at all interested in fractals. Check it out if you don't know what a fractal is. Either way, I think you're going to be amazed. Next up, and a lot less amazing, is X Games. This is the package name. There are, I don't know, 6 or 7 or 8 little, charitably, we could call them games, included in this package. Almost all of them either crashed or crashed upon exit. This is leaving my system. Remove PKG, X Games. But here's what are included in X Games. There's Maze. It draws a random maze, and then it solves it. Blink and you'll miss it, but don't worry, it just repeats infinitely. It just draws, solves. Clearly a demo application. All right, next up is Spider. That's solitaire. Specifically, apparently double deck solitaire. I actually don't know how to play solitaire or patience or anything like that, so I don't know why. I enjoy games. I enjoy solo games, but I just never got around to learning solitaire. It's a little bit silly, but this does look like it maybe could work. Although, as I've said, a lot of these crashed at worst, or at best crashed on exit. So I don't know. I don't think it's worth just, there's K Patience, for instance. I could just use that. Then there's X Color Map. This one appears, this is puzzling. It appears to just display a blue to black gradient across several cells of a grid. It doesn't seem to be interactive. If you click on it, it goes away. I don't know if that's a crash or if that's the intended result. There's no dash H or dash dash help menu. There's no man page. No idea what it's supposed to do. Sounds like it's supposed to maybe give you a map of colors or something, like an arrangement, assortment of colors, but it's just blue to black. I don't know. It feels like it's not working. I don't know. Maybe it is working. Maybe that's the intended result. A window divided into, let's say, 16 cells with a gradient spanning them from top to bottom. I don't know. It's weird. X-Cuckoo. When running outside of TWM, X-Cuckoo renders the error X-Cuckoo no window named TWM icon manager. Okay. Restart it in TWM. Okay. Well, now it just does a segmentation fault. So I don't know to this day what it's supposed to do. I thought it was going to be some kind of clock, like a cuckoo clock, but no, it's nothing. It is a crash. Here's another crash, except of a different kind, X-Lander. This one's cool. This one's fun. This is probably, like, if you're going to keep this package installed, this would be the reason. It's a 3D wireframe game about landing a space capsule on a very precarious landscape, actually. I have yet to succeed, which kind of leads me to think that maybe it's not really all that functional. And there is a thing in the man page that warns you that collision detection isn't terribly good in this game. In a game about trying to land a spacecraft on a precarious landscape, the bug that they choose to highlight in the man page is that they don't quite have collision detection down yet. I mean, what, like, landing, like, a touchdown, like, you have to you have to detect collision. That's so, I don't know. I'm dubious, but it is a lot of fun and it looks just so cool. I mean, super retro. It's wireframe. So you use the 2, 4, 6, and 8 keys, or I guess, 2, 4, and 6, and 8 keys on your numpad to control the thrusters of the space capsule. So you can go like left, right with 2 and 4, up and down. No, wait, 4 and 6. That's what those are. 4 and 6, up with 8 and then down with 2, but or back with 2 or forward with, I'm not sure. So I'm not entirely sure yet what triggers the landing process. It seems to trigger, I can't tell. I thought for a while it was when I pressed 2 that was the landing sequence, but I cannot tell. And the game sadly crashes too often for me to have like truly experimented with it enough to understand what like the sort of intended control scheme was. So it's a little bit frustrating that it doesn't seem to quite work, but it's so cool. It's so fun. And it's just, oh, it's beautiful. Those wireframes are just beautiful. It's like this, this planet with little cliffs and mountains and stuff, and you're just trying to land your capsule. I've landed, but it keeps telling me it has crashed. I mean, not the application in this case. The capsule crashes. Like, it crashes. I crash my capsule. Sometimes the application also crashes. It's kind of a mess. X Minesweep. I guess it's the Minesweeper game. I don't know enough about Minesweeper to know like how good or poor this implementation is. I can say that you click on squares on a grid, and some of them reveal numbers, which I assume are victory points, and then others are empty, and then one or two, or some of them, anyway, reveal a bomb, which instantly ends the game and reveals all of the squares to you. And then you can start over. I don't know. Is that what Minesweeper is? That sounds really boring to me. I'm not so sure about this game. All right, next up is X Neko. This is so cute. This is, again, if I was going to keep this package, this would be one of them that would convince me to do it. It's an animated little cartoon cat that chases your mouse pointer. And when you hover your mouse pointer over the window, it changes into a little mouse graphic. It is super cute, and it's almost truly enough to make me want to keep this on my system. The only downside to it is that the cat is bound to the window. You know, it's not like it just crawls all over your desktop. It's just in that little window, which is fine, but wouldn't it be cool if it was just on the root window? And when you exit the application, of course, you get a fatal IO error 4, which again makes me really uneasy about basically the state of all these games. I don't think there was one game that didn't either crash or crash on exit. It's just silly. Or wouldn't exit at all. Like some of them would just get stuck, like Control C. Well, actually, yeah, this one, X Roach. That's the last one. It supposedly generates animated cockroaches on the root window, which again, I wish X Neko had put the cat on the root window, but this one will put roaches on your desktop, essentially. And they skitter around your desktop and hide under windows. And then when you move a window, they skitter away and try to find another window to hide under. How disgusting. I ran it on XFCE and never saw a roach, so I don't know. Maybe I just run a really clean shop here. Maybe it would have worked better on GWM. Who knows? Maybe not. Anyway, when I'd given up on ever seeing a roach, which is a great thing to give up on. I'm happy never to see a roach. But when I finally gave up, I tried to quit X Roach, and I just couldn't. I Control C, Control C, Control C, Control D, Control D. Could not get the thing to stop running. So I just rebooted the virtual machine, and I will never boot those games up again. Not interesting to me. Okay, last, certainly not least, there is Zine Lib and Zine UI. I guess that's how you say it. It's X-I-N-E. It's a media player. Zine Lib is the back end, and Zine UI is the front end, as you can possibly imagine. You can launch it from your application menu or application screen, or you can just use the terminal, Zine, and then path to the media file that you want to play. It uses libraries from libAV codec or FFmpeg, and lots of other open source projects like, you know, Ogg and stuff like that, obviously. So it can pretty much play anything you throw at it, I think. I mean, it's one of those. It's one of those media players, and it's great. Most of the controls are hidden by default, but you can right-click on the Zine movie screen to access a menu, and from that menu, you can show or hide the play controls. You can select what stream to use for like your video and your audio and your subtitles. You can choose a theme for your player control panel. And a lot more than that. I mean, like, it's a menu with lots of controls in it. Many of the common selections you're going to learn have key bindings as well, so it's a little bit like MPlayer in that sense. You start to know the key bindings, and you don't have to bother with the menu anymore. The front end is skinnable, so you can have player controls in a variety of different looks. All of them look pretty dated to me, personally. They tend to be very small, often very pixelated, and often very cluttered. But it is easy to get skins. It feels very progressive. Like, this little application, this little media player, you can view and apply themes right in the Zine configuration window without ever, like, directly going, you know, you don't have to open up a web browser. It downloads a list of themes available. It shows you a preview of that theme, and then you can click, you know, to use that theme, and it installs it and applies it to your Zine instance right then and there. Like, it's really smooth. Like, shockingly smooth. It's just the skins themselves are not in any way smooth. The GNOME video player Totem used to use Zine libs. And as I recall, Zine used to be one of the main options for, like, what you wanted to use to play videos in, like, Firefox and other browsers a long time ago. Maybe currently as well. I'm not sure. I haven't looked lately. I think it's just all native now, right? Or it just kind of all happens within Firefox, I think. I don't know. But, I mean, probably Conqueror, you could probably outsource it to Zine or something. But GNOME Totem, which is now just called Videos, in like Fedora at least, it doesn't seem to depend on Zine anymore, so I'm not sure whether it's just, you know, not installed, but if I had installed it, it would be used by Totem, or if it's just not dependent upon Zine at all, I'm not really sure. I would say that Zine is a nice little player. Like, it's really nice. I don't use it because I have a lot of choices of media players on Linux, and that's a great thing to be able to say. As I've said before, when I was talking about MPlayer, I think it's so great that, like, the problem is I have too many great choices and can't use them all. Like, I love that. That's a great problem to have. I would definitely use Zine if that was, you know, all that was left, or if that was the one thing that I found pre-installed on a computer that I needed to quickly play a movie on or something. Really, really nice little player. And it does DVDs and CDs as well. So, I mean, it does. It really plays pretty much anything you need it to play. Nice little player. Check it out if you're looking for your next favorite media player. Apologies for the controllers, though, that there's no helping that. Use key bindings, I guess. I think that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening, and keep the source open.
we actually had to have a team of programmers work on that particular problem.